this episode, I'd like to introduce you to Jesse Moskal. Jesse's life reads a bit like a Shakespearean play. It's got tragedy, violence, death. It's got a comedy of errors. And it even has an international police chase to boot.
From 13 Media, I'm Trisha Jenkins, and this is Worldwide, the Unchosen Church.
I first met Jesse when we were in our early teens, at a three-week summer camp for church kids in Minnesota. Even back then, Jesse kind of struck me as a bad boy or a rebel. And that, combined with his good looks, actually attracted a lot of ladies at the camp. But at that time, I really had no idea about how or why Jesse's rebel persona had formed. Our paths crossed again in the mid-1990s for just a short time at Ambassador University. But after we left there, Jesse just kind of fell off my radar. I actually hadn't thought about him again until 2008, when I heard that he was facing a death sentence in Asia.
When he traveled to Thailand back in 2008, Jesse Moskal faced the death penalty for one drug charge and a life sentence for another in a Thailand prison.
Now, it would be far too simplistic to say that the Worldwide Church of God was the reason that Jesse ended up in prison. But the church certainly played a part. And to understand why, I think you have to understand something about the founders' ideas about healing and doctors. For starters, Herbert W. Armstrong preached that only God and not the medical community could provide true healing. He often disparaged doctors for knowing very little about what causes disease, and he claimed that they could only treat the symptoms of an illness rather than actually cure it. You can hear a sample of this from one of his sermons from 1979.
How many of you have been sick and you've gone to doctors? You go to one and then you go to another and another, and you don't get better. They don't seem to be able to help you, and you have grown worse. A doctor's drugs and medicines can't heal. There is no healing but a healing from God. Nothing else would be healing. They don't know the cause of cancer. They don't know the actual cause of many things today. And consequently, they don't know the one proper and sure cure. In fact, there's only one real cure, and that is that from God.
And that teaching, that only God can heal, is actually key to Jesse's story. Jesse grew up as the oldest in a family of six. His father was a head pastor in the Worldwide Church of God, which helps explain why they were so invested in Armstrong's ideas, even when his little sister was diagnosed with leukemia.
Yeah, this is a little more emotional for me because Molly Rebecca Moskal, she was would have been four. She died a few days before her birthday. Molly got sick around 2.5 years old with leukemia. And this was an unfortunate thing. Where we lived, there was some really nefarious stuff going on. These guys were burning toxic stuff at night. And we had a ceiling fan that pulled in these fumes, and her bedroom happened to be next to it. So she got sick. God, it brings back a lot of memories. WCG was always very strong on prayer. You know, if you got sick, basically you're supposed to call your pastor, and he would come. And my dad was the one that did this. He brought and I have one of these handkerchiefs right over here. He would bring a handkerchief, put some olive oil on it, and he kneeled down and pray over you. And if there was other people in the house, they'd pray as well. That was their approach. It was supernatural healing. They didn't believe strongly in doctors. While he got sick, it's, you know, there's this beautiful little 3-year-old, and they tried everything, every type of prayer they could, and they tried all types of naturopathic healing. They gave her a very small chance to live either way, and that's not how I initially remembered it. But in any case, there were a lot of cases where people could have gone to the doctor and perhaps gotten healed, but because of their ardent belief in WCG and that whole structure, they avoided the doctors, and I think there was a lot of unnecessary suffering and definitely some unnecessary deaths because of that.
Jesse isn't the only person that I know from the church who lost a loved one because they or their family refused to seek medical treatment. It's actually a far more common story than you would imagine. Even my own dad, who took his life after a long bout with depression, resisted taking an antidepressant medication, and instead he tried to cure himself with prayer and diet and natural supplements because of the church's teachings. And so I've often wondered if his fate, and my fate, would have turned out differently if we hadn't been a member of the church at the time. The irony that makes stories like ours even more painful is that Herbert W. Armstrong himself used doctors, especially as he aged. This is a clip from a documentary titled Called to Be Free. In it, you'll hear Ronald Stoddart, a former pastor of the WCG, talk about this directly.
We had a theology of not trusting doctors and instead just totally relying upon perfect healing.
Jesus had a perfect body. He was never sick a day in his life. He never had an ache or a pain. God is your own divine healer, not any man.
Now, a lot can be said about that because as Herbert Armstrong got older, he used doctors a lot. But still, he continued to teach that it was wrong. That didn't help the people who needed doctors.
I was curious if Jesse's sister's death made him wary of the church, or if it caused him to be angry with his parents. Or because if he was just a kid, when everything happened, did he just kind of move on and accept it without much introspection?
If the church hadn't been such a focal point in my entire life, then I would have had other interests. And maybe I wouldn't have thought about this so deeply as a youngster. But the fact that, you know, Molly dying and it being clear, in fact, after she died, they fled to Florida because there was a concern they were going to be arrested for a little while, my parents, because they didn't seek proper medical treatment. And there was a child endangerment issue. And I don't know how it was resolved. I'll probably never know now. But there was an issue there. And I was very acutely aware that, you know, mom and dad, their church has put one of us in the grave. And they may not have our best interests in mind. And so from a very young age, I was opposed to being in the church. In fact, the only reason you ever met me at Ambassador, because they said you can either go to local New York State school and live here, or you can go live in Booth City. And if I could live 2,000 miles away from mom and dad, I'll deal with the Ambassador staff. I can't be worse than mom and dad.
Jesse's life in the Worldwide Church of God also caused other problems for him. He says that as a kid, he felt very isolated and disconnected from other people his age. That's partly because his mother had homeschooled him and his siblings, but also because the church moved their family around a lot.
We kept moving. Every 3 years, they uprooted us and moved us to a different state. And I just remember a collection of broken things that they were never put together. Like, he built me a basketball goal, he put the backboard up, but he never got around to putting the rim up. So for 3 years, I just, like, shot off the backboard. I never had a rim. And we moved to a new place. He was always gone. You know, he's always, you know, was always take care of any church member that called. He would be off and running. You know, take care of them. So he was very absent.
Jesse's relationship with his parents was also complicated by one more thing, and that's that Jesse's dad seemed to demand complete obedience from his children. And so whenever they questioned him or the church, they got met with strong words, but sometimes even a fist.
These why questions never got answered to my satisfaction. You know, I was met with absolute authoritarianism and just demanded that I, you know, fall in line. And so for me, rebellion became my way. That, your willingness to hit your child, and I'm not talking about spankings proper, because that was a thing too, but their emotions got the better of them. And I think that that culminated in a lot of antisocial behavior in myself.
And that antisocial behavior was actually exacerbated by one of the church's other beliefs. The beliefs that the end times were near. Very near. Jesse says that that belief actually prevented his parents from thinking about the kind of skills that he and his siblings might need in order to function in the modern world as adults.
Yeah, so because, for instance, this idea that we were going to go into a rapture, it basically made half of the stuff that you'd normally teach a child irrelevant. That contributed to mom and dad not worrying about teaching their children to be, shall we say, whole human beings who can exist in this world in a state of relative peace and happiness. I think it was more like, ah, shit, we screwed this up, but don't worry. Jesus will sort it all out when he returns. But I really didn't know how to interact in the world. And the only reason I stopped going to homeschool is because I refused to be taught by my mom. Actually, when I was in fifth grade, I think I was 11 years old. I was like, no more. I'm done. And I want to see what's out there. And so that was, you know, kind of the beginning of the rebellion.
But Jesse never completely broke away from his family. Instead, he learned to split himself into two. He had a home and a church, Jesse, which towed the line in order to avoid being hit or punished. And then he had what he called the real Jesse, someone that he could only be when he was away from home.
I was kind of stuck between two worlds, in a sense. I wanted to know what the real world was doing. I felt like that was where things were, but I didn't have the tools to interact there. It was like a comedy of errors. I remember the first year I went to school, I went in and there was a test I hadn't studied for. It was like a pop test in biology, and there was 10 questions, and I only knew 6. But somehow I'd had it in my mind that if I answered any of the questions, I'd get a negative score versus leaving them all blank and getting a 0. So, like, I just didn't understand anything that was happening outside of WCG and the confines of my home. That made me very uncomfortable in the real world, and that also pushed me into drugs. You know, my parents expected me to behave a certain way, and certain behaviors were not permissible or tolerated. So if I had to put on a front to be involved with stuff, then I just did it, but I knew it wasn't me. And then to be myself, I had to be away from the house. And so it's very difficult to maintain a life with two faces, you know, and it creates a lot of mental anguish and stress. And I used to believe in the whole notion of addiction. Now I'm not so sure. I think addiction is merely unprocessed trauma.
Jesse says that his trauma did eventually get processed during his time in prison. But to understand how he even ended up in prison, you have to understand how Jesse's isolated adolescence and the pain of his sister's death and his harsh and at times abusive parents sent him down a risky path.
I would always seek out lots of drugs and alcohol to kind of numb myself. At one point in particular, I was living in Miami, and the place was awash in cocaine and lots of other, you know, drugs. And so I'd gotten myself into a lot of trouble with the law, and I needed a reset, a real hard reset, and just happened to stumble across a job in Korea as a teacher. And I've got a degree in English literature, so that was handy. And I just thought, gee, I can cross half the world and put some stamps on my passport and hopefully get some healing and get away from this situation that's really just gotten out of hand. So that was 31. I was age 31. I went over to Korea. You know, you can run from yourself, but you just can't escape yourself. And eventually I caught up with myself.
Jesse has said that he originally thought that Korea would be a good idea because there didn't seem to be much of a drug scene in the country. But things actually got worse and not better there. At first, he just started doing some pot on the weekends to help him unwind after work. But then his fellow teachers started to join him, and that led him to hooking those teachers up with pot. And then one thing led to another, and after a while, he found himself essentially running an international supply chain of MDA, or ecstasy, for the expat community living in Korea at the time.
You know, as a drug dealer in Asia, I wasn't really trying to be nefarious. I was just trying to connect. Like, it felt good to be, like, to have people seeking me out. It felt good to, you know, to be the person that could hook people up and give them what they wanted. And I felt like kind of like a party coordinator. I wasn't really thinking of myself as a major drug dealer. It did spiral that way. There was 15,000 teachers in Korea. And all of them, I mean, if you're the type of person that can just jump off from your life in America and go over to Korea to teach English for a year, you probably smoke pot and you might do some ecstasy. And you were kind of pretty much just like me. So there was like 15,000 of us over there. And I think I met or interacted with almost every one of those people over the course of 2 years when I was selling drugs in Korea. As you know, that sort of illegality doesn't go forever. There's eventually a time where the police are going to come knocking, and they certainly got me locked up pretty good.
The Korean police actually never caught Jesse. They visited his apartment to search it for drugs, but he just happened to be out. His girlfriend, who was home, then called to tip him off, warning him that he should not come back to the apartment and that he should actually get out of the country. Fast. So Jesse eventually boarded a plane to get to Thailand. But in Thailand, his luck ran out. The story of Jesse's time in Asia is actually featured in episode 2 of season 10 of the National Geographic series Locked Up Abroad. Jesse's episode is called The Korean Kingpin, if you want to check it out. Here are a few clips from that show, though, to help you get a sense of what his life was like at that time.
My past has been painful, but once that drug came into the picture, everything completely changed. Business was making at least 10 grand a week. You're looking at $40,000, $50,000 a month. The biggest problem was what to do with all the money. I knew that Korean police would pass the names onto some sort of international list. We ultimately decided to risk it and buy a ticket to Thailand. Even though I'd had troubles with my parents, by this time it would have been nice to see them. My brother is the same, but how could I tell them what's happening? That I was a wanted man. It really all added up to more than I could bear. So eventually I let Carl talk me into ordering a small shipment into Thailand. Thai police were very, very keen to trap foreigners with drugs. I knew that there were harsh penalties. Bangkok Central Prison was foreboding. I was unable to defend myself. The truth is, it was torture. And it went on for a long time. And it was really brutal. Anything over 20 grams of MDMA gives you a life sentence. But even worse than that, you got caught with baggies, pills, and a scale.
That's manufacturing.
Anytime you see that charge, manufacture, it's a death penalty.
To say that life inside the prison was tough would be a massive understatement. Jesse was originally sleeping with like 70 people on a dirty floor in a very small room, and they all shared a single toilet. He saw abuse and torture, and some of his friends died. But the place, he says, also offered him time and reflection. And it was sort of an emotional and spiritual and intellectual renaissance of sorts.
Prison was actually one of the better things that's ever happened to me in life. It allowed me to change, allowed me to reconnect with myself, and I did a lot of writing. You know, if you think about all the distractions we have in modern life, being in a Thai prison, certainly a third world country with very few accoutrements, and basically like an 18-hour day where you're just sort of sitting there going, all right, I can either, you know, stultify myself or I can edify what I've got, and I chose the latter. So I learned to speak another language and another language and read something like 580 books. So it became the most intellectual period in my life. and physically as well. So yeah, one of the most wonderful periods of my life, born out of the absolute worst.
Another great thing to come out of that time in prison is that Jesse and his dad were actually able to reconnect. And if you're wondering how that happened, that too is actually tied to the church. When Herbert W. Armstrong died, he passed the baton to a new leader. And just a few years later, that new leader actually renounced all of Armstrong's teachings. And that renunciation forced a lot of people in the church to feel like they had to make a choice between the old and the new. They felt like they either had to label the new leadership as a false prophet and hold on to Armstrong's teachings, or they had to look at the new leadership's theology and say, yeah, I think that we were wrong to have always been so legalistic. And they adapted. But that choice was not easy, and it wreaked a lot of havoc on families.
That rift, a lot of people stayed WCG and ended up United, and very few, it seemed to me, fully made the 180-degree turn to go from everything they'd learned and acquired mentally to shift into that new era where they were trying to be more like everybody else and renounce all their unique aspects. My dad made that shift fully, and it caused him to lose his wife because she didn't want to. But, you know, in your late 50s, to make a change like that and become something completely new and to be an old dog and learn new tricks. Like, for me, that was the most beautiful thing that ever happened for my dad in his career as a WCG person. And especially after I went to prison and after my mom divorced him, those were the things that, you know, were kind of, you can't do those things when you're a WCG pastor. You can't have children in prison. You can't divorce your wife. You know, you're a pastor. You know, so for those things, those horrible things in his mind to happen to him, those are probably the best things that ever happened because they made him realize, you know, hey, let me get away from the edge here and come back towards the middle and be a decent human being. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I think I hope I'm capable of is to, you know, basically start over, I guess, in a way and just realize maybe you were wrong your whole life and not to cling to it, but to, you know, refashion and remake. And I think that's why he lived such a full life. The man he became is the one that I'm working towards becoming now.
So failure, it seems, teaches us a lot. It makes us more humble and more empathetic. And those things can't help but repair relationships that have been damaged. And one other interesting thing happened to Jesse when he was in prison. He rediscovered Christianity.
I'm embarrassed to say, but when I first got there, I'll be honest, I kept dealing because dealing in the world is dangerous, but dealing behind bars in prison is the safest thing you can ever do because what are they going to do, arrest you? Now I was in prison and I had this whole network of international contacts and I got to say, you know, I think I paid 10 grand US for a cell phone. And so I had a cell phone in prison, so I call her, say, go pick up this, and go drop it off here. And then I started dealing bigger and bigger. So that's when it really blew up, the first year in prison. The second year I was there, there was a fellow called Mark Blanford who came over from Texas, which I thought was pretty interesting. But he's a Christian whose parents had been missionaries. His wife, Charlotte, her parents were missionaries, and they had brought her up in Africa. So the two of them finally met. I don't know what point in their life, but, you know, they both said, hey, both of our parents were missionaries. This is amazing. They fell in love. They got married. He was an engineer. And because he could speak Thai so well, they came. And one day I just looked up and some Nigerians came over and said, hey, you need to go see this guy. He's an American in the prison. And I hadn't seen another American for years. So I went over there pretty quick. And lo and behold, Mark Blanford and his wife, Charlotte, were there to teach Thai people about Jesus, and they brought a stack of New Testament Bibles in Thai, and he inspired me to do a whole lot of things that I probably never would have done. He did baptize me. He baptized me within 6 months. I was eager for some sort of clarity, and I already had all the pieces growing up. He didn't try to feed me into the BS, and he didn't push me at all. He just kind of let me. He just showed me where the water was, and I was eager to drink. So yeah, I was baptized in 2009. in the Thai prison in a bathtub.
When I asked Jesse why, when he was in an environment that was mostly inhabited by Buddhists, that this was the moment in his life that felt right to re-embrace Christianity. And he freely admitted that it was a combination of both the emotional desperation that he was facing, the privileges that it afforded him inside the prison, and his past.
The right elements came together at that time. Mark had a very simple version of Christianity available to me. And I was really searching for a way to make things have a meaning. Plus, I was lonely. You know, like my first couple of years before I really spoke Thai, you know, we were just kind of limping along. It was very lonely. So I think that helped. Oddly enough, the primary foreign faction in the prisons in Thailand is Africans. And I've grown to love Africans in the prison. And they all have these incredibly big hearts for Jesus. They all believe very strongly, you know, and I mean, absurd things. Like one, I remember Prince, one of the guys I lived with, he was a big heroin dealer. I think he got caught with something like 400 kilos of heroin, which is, you know, like 40 million US. And he had an ardent belief that God gave me the heroin connection I have, and that's why I have to be a drug dealer. Like, he took it as a calling from God. So they had these flexible beliefs in that regard. So there was a lot of other things that made Christianity the right choice for me. I could have become a Buddhist, but that wouldn't have differentiated me from the crowd. And being a Christian gave me a lot of privileges because ultimately I was probably the only foreigner in a while that could talk to the people. So they gave me all kinds of privilege. I was allowed to leave my building and go to other areas of the prison and teach Christianity and baptize people and do all kinds of stuff. So, like, you know, that was what I saw my dad doing when I was growing up. And he and I reconciled while I was in prison. So, you know, those are other big factors. But the thing I wanted to tell you was midway through this journey of mine where I'm kind of becoming a super Christian again, remolded in my own ideology, I looked at the Buddhist, I looked at the Christian, I looked at the Islam, and they're all the same to me. You know, I sat with those guys for the whole month of Ramadan several years in a row. We all ate together. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to be that Christian. You know, I'm not going to thumb my nose at all these other people and act condescending like my family did, like our church did. And it was a different approach, and it felt right, and it felt good.
The U.S. State Department was eventually able to extradite Jesse. Because conditions in Thai prisons are so harsh, the U.S. government actually considers 1 year of time served in Thailand to be the equivalent of 6 years served in the U.S. So when Jesse was returned to the States, he was actually considered to have completed his time served, and he was released. I feel like if this were some kind of mainstream, inspirational, dramatic movie, that this is where the movie would end. And it would be an amazing, touching tale of someone who overcame a tragic beginning, who owned up to their demons, and re-emerged with the help of a missionary, Jesus Christ, to become a beacon on a hill for others. But real life rarely ends up like the movies. And if we're going to be honest in this podcast, I feel like I have to say that Jesse doesn't actually identify very much with Christianity anymore. After returning home, it's possible that the deep emotional holes that it filled for him just weren't there anymore. Jesse still has faith in a creator, though.
I'm looking out the window here. I live in this beautiful 10-acre lot on the lake, and I spend a lot of my time outdoors, and, you know, when I look at all the things around me, like, I know that there's some sort of creation, but there's too many beautiful things here for this all to be an accident. You know, it's just impossible to me. So I know there's some sort of creative force out there. I think that all of the religions we're discussing are basically man's pitiful efforts to describe what that creative force is and does. I don't feel any affinity towards Christianity. I've gone to church maybe two or three times in the last year or 2 years. and left with a bad taste in my mouth. You know, a lot of that stuff gets political these days, and there's really nothing for me.
Some listeners might be disappointed with that ending. Others might be completely satisfied. Either way, I think that Jesse's story is a really powerful one. It's a story of fractured family relationships and how we try to heal from them in our adulthood. It's also the story of how spiritual identity, for a lot of people, just evolves over the course of a lifetime, shifting as our circumstances and our needs also change. When Jesse got out of prison in 2013, he made a list of goals that he wanted to accomplish, and he went after them with a sharply focused mind. He wanted a career and a wife, a lot of the things that you would expect. And he checked that list off. He said that in 2 years, he had basically accomplished everything that he had set out to do, except for one thing. He wanted a family, a kid. And that goal continued to elude him for years. But I'm happy to say that 5 months before I interviewed Jesse for this story, he became the proud father of a baby girl, who he named Molly, after his sister. Next up on Worldwide, the Unchosen Church.
Growing up, I found the church to be extremely racist. They never led with it, but there was a lot of white supremacist elements to the Worldwide Church of God. I feel like I studied at the feet of charlatans. I see what the power of story did. Power of story had us running around the woods with a bunch of crazies talking about Petra, had black people up in a white supremacist Jesus cult. That's what the power of story did. I think it's one of the biggest questions of my life is, what the hell are we doing there?
Unless you want to risk the lake of fire, we highly recommend listening to that episode on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are made available. Worldwide, the Unchosen Church is written, produced, and hosted by me, Trisha Jenkins. Editing and sound design by 13 Media. Music licensed by Soundstripe. I'd like to extend a special thank you today to Jesse Moskal for sharing his story with us, and to thank you, favored listener, for taking the time to hear it. If you'd like to send us a question or comment, please reach out via email at worldwidepod11@gmail.com or DM us on social media. You can find us on Instagram at worldwidepod and on Twitter and Facebook at worldwidepod11. So long as the apocalypse hasn't arrived by our next episode, we hope you'll join us again.